Three different phyla within the kingdom protista. We talked about the Chrysophyta, the Pyrophyta, and the Euglenophyta, which were all heterotrophic types of protists, or excuse me, autotrophic types of protists. Today we want to talk about another group of protists that are all heterotrophic. In other words, they feed on other organisms. The first of those phyla that we want to talk about is the phylum Zoomastigina. The phylum Zoomastigina are sometimes called the flagellates. Now, flagellates are all heterotrophic organisms. Some of them are free-living, and some of them are actually parasitic. Some of them actually are symbiotic with other organisms. This is a protist here, a Zoomastigina protist, at least a picture of one. And you can see the single flagellum at the posterior end of the body, and that is the distinguishing characteristic of these organisms. Okay, this particular trypanosoma, this is a parasite that can be found in humans, and you can actually see in this picture here the red blood cells, and then you can see the trypanosomes or the flagellates here. Okay. This particular parasite lives in the circulatory system and it's typically picked up by eating poorly cooked or uncooked pork. Okay, you've all heard that you cook your bacon well or whatever, your pork chops. And that's because pork many times will have trypanosomes associated with them. Can make you very ill. Some other Zoomastigina flagellates are actually free-living. Some of them are found in freshwater environments. There are also some Zoomastiginans that are what we call mutualists or symbiotic mutualists with other organisms such as termites. Remember when we talked about termite? Actually, we didn't talk about termites. I was thinking of another class. In termites, termites cannot digest wood. Does that surprise you? I mean, you think about it, what do they eat? Wood. If they can't digest it, then they're in trouble, right? Okay. And actually, what they do is they have in their gut, they have these zoomastiginins, and the zoomastiginins are the ones that help break down the lignin in the wood so that they can get energy from wood. Okay. And so termites cannot digest wood on their own. They have these flagellates in their gut. Any questions about that? It's kind of interesting. How do termites get the flagellates in their gut? Well, next time you see a termite colony, before you wipe them out, watch them for a while. And what they'll do is they're always touching their rear ends together. And what they do is they line up their anuses and they allow these flagellates to swim back and forth from through anal contact. Okay? So that's how they get them in their gut. Any questions about the Zoomastiginins? These are actually termite flagellates here that have been extracted out of the termite gut. Again, you can see the single flagellum here. Okay. The next phylum is the phylum Sarcodina. The phylum Sarcodina, are sometimes called Sarcodines, are the common name for them. The phylum Sarcodina are typically found in freshwater environments when they're free-living. However, many of them can be parasites, and they can be parasites of humans and cause intestinal problems most of the time when they're parasites. Amoeba is an example of a Sarcodine. Okay. All Sarcodines have one characteristic in common, and that is they have something that we call pseudopodia. What does the word pseudopodia mean? Pseudo means what? False or fake, okay? Podia are feet, okay? So they have false or fake feet. Essentially, what these pseudopodia are is they're extensions of the organism's body. And you can see a pseudopodia in this picture right there. And the reason why we call them pseudopodia is not the same part of the body doesn't always extend and become kind of the foot. It can be basically any part of their body. So basically any part of their body, if they wanted to move this direction here, this part of the organism would just extend out, attach to a substrate, and then pull the rest of the organism along. So I think of it kind of like in some of the movies, the slime balls that you see, you know, there's a piece of them that extends out and kind of pulls the rest of the organism along with it. That's essentially how pseudopodia work. Okay. Amoeba is a very common protist in freshwater environments. And amoeba, if you drink untreated water, amoeba can cause dysentery as well as many of the other sarcodines. Most sarcodines, with the exception of some of the amoebas and some other closely related organisms, have shells around them that are made up of calcium carbonate.
Is that most of them?
What's that?
Is that most of the sarcodines?
Most of the sarcodina have calcium carbonate shells. And these calcium carbonate shells, actually there's an amoeba there. Most of these calcium carbonate shells have lots of holes in them. And what the holes are for is they're actually for the pseudopodia to extend out and be able to attach to a substrate and move these organisms around. We find these in freshwater environments quite extensively. In fact, when freshwater, large bodies of freshwater dry out, and sometimes even marine waters dry out, you'll have large deposits of these organisms, and they can make a type of rock that we call limestone. Most of you know we have limestone around here at the bases of the valley, and that's because of the sarcodines that were deposited there when we last had an ocean here, a big inland sea. Okay. Actually, here in this valley, it wasn't part of Lake Bonneville, but it was kind of a similar type of big inland sea. Okay. And if you look at the limestone deposits that you can find in the foothills here, like the stuff that the Manti Temple is made out of, you can actually go look at it, and you can actually see the fossilized remains of these organisms as well as snails and other organisms in the limestone. Okay. Any questions about the sarcodina? Right, the next group of protists that we want to talk about is the phylum Ciliophora. The phylum Ciliophora, anybody want to guess as to what their key characteristic is? Cilia, yeah. These are sometimes what we call the ciliates. Okay, easy enough to remember. This one, hopefully, nobody will miss on the test. So the Ciliophora can have cilia. Okay. Again, these organisms are typically found in freshwater environments. They include organisms such as the paramecium. Some of you in high school biology might have looked at a paramecium underneath a microscope. But if you look here at this drawing of the paramecium, you can see all of the cilia that surrounds the body. So again, the key characteristic of these organisms are cilia. Also, with the ciliates, they can be parasitic and cause intestinal problems if you drink untreated water. Okay. So the Ciliophora, pretty easy to remember, they have cilia. Okay. This is an example of a ciliate here. You can kind of see some of the cilia extending out around the body of this organism. This is a paramecium, and you can kind of see the light areas around the edges of the paramecium. Those are the cilia. They're actually diffracting the light or bending the light, so it's kind of has a little glow around the edge of the paramecium. Okay. And this is a micrograph of a ciliate, which is really a high-powered piece of equipment that magnifies organisms great numbers of times. Okay, and you can see that this particular ciliate here has so many cilia on it, it almost looks like it has hair. Okay, all of these structures are cilia. Just kind of Interesting side note, this thing right here, that's a pollen grain. Okay. Any questions about the Soleophora? The last phylum within the kingdom Protista that we want to talk about is the phylum Apicomplexa. The phylum Apicomplexa are sometimes called the Apicomplexans, pretty easy common name. These organisms are all parasitic. Okay, all of them are parasitic, and they all have what we call a complex life cycle. All right, and so those two characteristics distinguish it, the Apicomplexans from the other protists. Many of the other protists are parasitic, but they do not have a complex life cycle. They have a simple life cycle. Probably the best known of the Apicomplexans is organisms in the genus Plasmodium. The genus Plasmodium are commonly known as malaria organisms. So there are a number of different species of malaria. Some are more virulent than others. For example, there are some strains of malaria in the central part of Africa that if you get them, you're probably going to die. Okay. I actually had a student a couple of years ago that had served an LDS mission in Ghana, and he was really sick all the time, and I got talking to him, and he had malaria. He had caught malaria in Ghana, and he ended up dying during the semester that he's taking classes here for malaria. So it can be a very, very serious problem. But these organisms have a complex life cycle. What that means is that they need to live in at least two different hosts or more. In this case, it's just two different hosts in order to complete the life cycle of the organism. Okay. So with malaria, what happens is the, I guess you could say the mature part of the malaria life cycle occurs in a human being or in some other primates, and they exist in the liver and in the bloodstream. Periodically, what will happen is they'll go into a reproductive phase, and they'll release the immature stages in the bloodstream. Then what happens is the second part of the complex life cycle is a mosquito in the genus Anopheles. The Anopheles mosquito, if they bite you when you're in this reproductive malarial phase, then they can actually pick up the malaria protists, and the rest of the life cycle occurs inside of the gut of the mosquito, and then as the mosquito bites you again, they can transfer that malaria back into you. Okay, so malaria is transferred by mosquitoes. All right, malaria is typically a bigger problem in tropical countries. The simple reason is because in tropical countries you typically have more mosquitoes. There's more water for them to breed in and so forth. If any of you have ever been to a tropical country, you're going to be bit by a mosquito. The other thing that I might mention is it's pretty easy to understand how the disease would be transferred from the human to the mosquito, right? Because they're sucking up the blood. But how does the disease transfer from the mosquito back into the human? What's that?
Is it from sucking blood from somebody else before you transfer into their body?
Yes, but how do they transfer it?
They spit in your blood.
What's that?
They spit in your blood.
Yeah, they basically spit into you before they start sucking. Okay. And when you get a mosquito that bites you, the very first thing that it does is it spits an anticoagulant into your blood. That's why after you've been bitten by a mosquito and you slap it, it bleeds for a while. You ever notice that? You can't stop it from bleeding for a few seconds. It's not that big of a deal to us, but for the mosquito, what they don't want to happen is they don't want to actually have the blood clotting in their straw-like mouth part. They want to get that blood into the digestive tract. And so they'll actually spit an anticoagulant into the blood before they actually suck the blood. Does that make sense to everybody? So malaria belongs to it's probably the best known of the Apicomplexans. This is actually showing the malarial protists. These are the malaria protists. These are red blood cells from a human. Okay. So the malaria protist is about the same size as a red blood cell. Any questions about the Apicomplexa? Okay. So, the next thing I want to do, that's pretty much goes through all the protists that I want to talk about in this class. We talked about seven different phyla in the kingdom of Protista. What I'd like us to do now is to be able to write a dichotomous key for the kingdom, for the phyla within the kingdom of Protista. Okay. How can we start that dichotomous key? What are two characteristics that separate them out into two groups?
Autotrophic.
Okay. So 1A and 1B. The autotroph and heterotroph. Now, with the autotrophs, how many phyla are within the autotrophic group? Okay, there's three. So we need to go to another number to separate them out, right? So the next number in line is 2A, so we'll just go to 2A, 2B. How is one of those three autotrophic phyla different from the other two? They all can photosynthesize. Okay, we have two that have flagella, one that doesn't, right? The euglenophyta and the pyrophyta both have flagella. The chrysophyta does not. So we can use that characteristic and we're going to use that. Another thing that we could use is what? Marine, freshwater, right? Because one of them's freshwater, the euglenophyta, two of them are marine. Or we could use silica shells, no silica shells because the chrysophyta have silica shells. That makes sense to everybody. So there are a number of characteristics that we could use. Let's just use the one that we first mentioned here. Flagellum present, and then flagellum absent. Let's call it absent. It's not right, is it?
That's right.
You guys, you ought to try and spell in front of the class. Your mind just goes, oh. That's not right. That's right. The flagella present will need to go to 3A because there are two with flagella present, right? Flagellum absent, that would be the chrysophyta. Alright. So we'll go to 3A, 3B. How are the euglenophyta and the pyrophyta different from one another?
Within the freshwater.
Okay, we could use freshwater marine, right? What else could we use?
Phytoplankton.
What?
Phytoplankton.
Okay, one of them is a part of phytoplankton. We could have used that as a characteristic.
Bioluminescent.
We could have used bioluminescent, not bioluminescent. Okay, so any of those characteristics would be fine. All right. Let's just use the first one. Freshwater would be euglenophyta, and the marine would be pyrophyta. Okay. Any questions about that? Okay, is that all of our autotrophic phyla? It is, right? Okay. So now, what is the next number? Well, it's 4, so let's go to 4A with the heterotrophs, okay? 4A, 4B. What separates out one or more groups of heterotrophs and separates them from the other heterotrophs?
Cilia.
What?
Cilia.
Okay, we could use that. Cilia? No cilia. So this would be ciliophora. This we would go to 5A. What else could we use to separate? Now we have the Zomastigina, the Sarcodina, and the Apicomplexa. What other characteristic could we use to separate out one or more of them? What? Complex life cycle? Okay. So complex life cycle, that would be Apicomplexa. Simple life cycle, we would go to 6A, 6B, okay? How would we separate the last two? One of them has, there are really three characteristics we could use. We could use flagella, no flagella, pseudopodia, no pseudopodia, right? Or we could use calcium carbonate shells or no calcium carbonate shells. Does that make sense? All those three characteristics would apply. So let's just do this. Let's say pseudopodia and flagella. So those are contrasting in the way they move. Pseudopodia would be sarcodyna, and the flagellum one would be the zoomastigina. Any questions about that? So if you were to memorize the dichotomous key like this, you would know most of the characteristics, right? If you wanted to kind of be a little bit more sure that you would remember all of the characteristics, you might just put some of the other ones here. For example, pyrophora, bioluminescent, chrysophora, marine. The sarcodyna have calcium carbonate shells. You know, and that would pretty much help you to remember all the characteristics of the protists. And then also be able to tell how they're similar and how they're different, right? Any questions about that? We could easily write another dichotomous key. We could start out and not worry about autotrophs, heterotrophs at first. We could say flagella, no flagella, because there's three that have flagellum, right? And then separate out the others. So there's lots of ways you could write a dichotomous key. Any questions about that? Yeah, go ahead.
So the last two things on the Bautista handout, do we just not need to worry about?
Yeah, we're not going to worry about them. Okay. Slime molds. Okay. Any questions about the Bautista? Okay, the next kingdom that we want to talk about then is the kingdom fungi. The kingdom fungi are what we sometimes call the funguses. Okay? Now, you can say fungi either, I've heard it pronounced a number of different ways. Some people say it fungi, but some people say it fungi, okay, or fungi, fungi. Okay? There's lots of different ways of saying the funguses. Funguses, however, if you remember when we were talking about characteristics of the kingdom fungi, we said that they had a number of characteristics. They were multi-cell eukaryotic organisms, remember that? They were heterotrophic, they were immobile, and the way in which they got their food was they were actually saprobes. What did saprobes mean again? Yeah, they digest their food outside of their bodies. They're going to release digestive enzymes, digest the food outside of their body, and then absorb those digested nutrients. Okay? Any questions about that? So with that in mind, let's talk about some of the characteristics of the fungus. Since the fungus cannot move from one place to another, what typically happens with the fungus is it basically runs out of food in the direct spot where it first starts growing. Now, funguses typically start to grow with a structure that is called a spore. Okay. And basically what a spore is, it's a little tiny structure that is basically like a zygote of these organisms. And spores are commonly released into the air. That's basically how the funguses reproduce and get organisms to other places. Okay. So, I think I might have that. So once that spore, if the spore lands in a suitable environment, it's going to grow. If it doesn't land in a suitable environment, it's not going to grow. Okay. So spores are not like seeds, however. Seeds kind of work in the same way that spores do, right? A lot of seeds can be airborne even. But what happens with a spore is spores, if they don't land in a suitable environment, they die really pretty quick. Okay. So if a spore were to land on top of this tabletop up here, if there wasn't a piece of food or something that it could feed on, it would actually die very, very quickly. That makes sense to everybody. However, if I had a bowl of soup here and it landed in the bowl of soup, then there would be plenty of nutrients for it to grow, right? Okay. Have you ever wondered how you get, you make your soup one day and you've made too much, so you put it in a Tupperware bowl or whatever, put it in your fridge, and then 2 days later you come back and say, well, I'm going to eat that, my leftover soup, and you open up your Tupperware bowl and it has what? Fungus growing on the top of it. Have you ever had that happen? Or the same thing, how does the funguses get inside of your bread sack? Does that make sense? So how does the fungus get inside of the Tupperware bowl or inside of the bread sack?
When you're 13 or when you open it?
Yeah, when you open it up, there's spores in the air. And those spores just happen to land in the right place. Okay? So there are spores constantly in the air around us. In fact, today in this room, how many spores do you think are floating around, fungal spores are floating around in this room? There's actually quite a few, okay? I don't know, on a real cold, we're cold outside, so we don't have as many funguses now. Typically, funguses grow best in warm, wet environments, all right? So since we're dry and cold, we probably don't have as many today as we normally would have. But in one of my upper division biology classes, we actually had to figure out how many spores were in a classroom. It was during a spring semester, but when it got a little bit warmer. And so we put this little sheet up on the wall with double-sided sticky tape. Then each of us were responsible for a centimeter square segment of this, and we had to put it underneath a microscope and count the number of spores that we saw. And actually, in a centimeter square, we were getting close to 5 to 10,000 spores per centimeter square. Okay, so there's a lot of spores typically floating around. As I mentioned, funguses typically do better in warm, humid environments. I don't know if any of you have ever lived in a warm, humid environment before. I lived in Houston for a while, and down in southwest Louisiana. And if you would leave like dishes in the sink, and you didn't completely rinse them out when you left at breakfast time, you'd come back at lunch and you'd have fungus growing in your soup, in your bowl. There were that many spores around them, and they got growing that fast. So, any questions about spores? So that's one way in which the funguses can reproduce, is by producing spores and then releasing those spores. Typically, but not always, spores are a result of sexual reproduction. Funguses can also reproduce asexually through a type of asexual reproduction that we call vegetative asexual reproduction. Okay? So some funguses actually never produce spores, but what they do is they'll produce these structures that we're going to call hyphae. And we'll talk about what hyphae are here in a minute. And then those hyphae may break off, and they'll be able to form a new fungus, okay? So when a spore lands on a suitable environment, the first thing that it starts to do is it starts to grow these structures that are called hyphae. Now, if you remember, funguses can't move. And so let's say the fungus on your bread, once it feeds on the food right below it, it really doesn't have a lot more food. Now, there's a lot of food on a piece of bread, right? There's a lot of nutrients, so they really don't run out of food in that situation. But what they do is they actually grow hyphae outward, and that way they not only can digest the food where the spore landed, but they can also digest food out and around where the spore landed. Does that make sense? So the hyphae are basically how they grow. Once we get a whole bunch of hyphae, we call that a mycelium or a mycelial mat. Okay. So mycelium, it's actually right here. The mycelium is just a mat of hyphae. Okay. So as long as there's food in surrounding areas, the fungus can actually keep growing these hyphae out broader and broader and eventually use up all the resources in an area. Okay. Any questions about that? Now, what will sometimes happen is the fungus may start producing either asexually or sexually, and they will produce a structure that we call a fruiting body. Okay, you see a picture of a fruiting body here, and the fruiting body are where the spores are formed. So eventually from that fruiting body can release spores, and then those spores can be airborne. If they land in a suitable environment, they can start growing new hyphae. Okay. Any questions about that? Okay, so with the funguses, they grow this hyphae. Once you get a whole bunch of hyphae, it's called a mycelium. They may or may not produce a fruiting body, and the fruiting body is where spores are produced. And fruiting bodies can be a result of asexual or sexual reproduction, typically sexual. Okay. Any questions about the general life cycle of a fungus? Okay, we're going to talk about some divisions within the kingdom fungi. Now, if you remember in our taxonomic hierarchy, we had domain, kingdom, phylum, right? Was the way we learned it. But if you remember, I told you that botanists use the term division instead of phylum. The same thing is true of mycologists. Mycologists are people who study funguses, okay? Mycologists use the term division instead of phylum. So when you see that term division up there, that's the same as phylum in the taxonomic hierarchy. Okay? Any questions about that? So the first division that we're going to talk about is the division Oomycota. And the division Oomycota are sometimes called the egg fungi. Alright? Any questions about that? Now, one thing that you'll find in all of the divisions of the fungi is all of their names, all of the division names will end in mycota. Mycota is Latin for fungus. Alright. So the division Oomycota, so let me just skip ahead a few slides here. The next division we're going to talk about, you don't need to write this one down yet, the division Zygomycota. See that same ending there? Okay. And the distinguishing characteristic of these organisms is typically the sporing structure. There are other distinguishing characteristics, but for our purposes in this class, we're going to use sporing structures as distinguishing characteristics. And the sporing structure always has a name similar to the division name. For example, in the Oomycota, their distinguishing structure are called structures are called oospore and Oosporangia. Okay. So with the Zygomycota, what's going to be their distinguishing characteristic? Zygosporangia. Does that make sense? Okay. So this is pretty easy to remember the differences between the fungus, hopefully. All right. If you can remember their name, the division name always ends in mycota. Distinguishing structure typically, not always, most of the time, ends in sporangia. Okay, so you take the first few letters of the name, Oomycota, you put them on to sporangia, you have the distinguishing characteristic. Okay. Any questions about that? The Oomycota, as I mentioned, are sometimes called the egg fungi, or another common name for them are the water moles. Typically you find Oomycota in aquatic environments or semi-aquatic environments. Maybe one of the places that you guys have seen Oomycota before is, have any of you ever seen in a fish tank where a fish will have kind of a little white thing that's attached to its body, a white streamer? That's actually the fish has a fungus on it, and those are Oomycete funguses or Oomycota funguses. Okay. Another place where you'll see a lot of Oomycota in the water is when you see a dead organism like a frog or a fish in the water. And you've seen a dead frog or dead fish in the water? They're covered with white slimy stuff. You ever notice that before? Those are Oomycota funguses. Alright? And so funguses, not just Oomycota, but many of the funguses are very important for not only humans, but for all organisms throughout the world. Because most of your funguses, what they do is they help to degrade dead and dying organic material. So for example, if you didn't have Oomycota funguses in the water, you might have a pond full of dead fish that couldn't break down, couldn't deteriorate. Does that make sense to everybody? They help to deteriorate dead organic material like the dead fish. All right? Any questions about that? Another place where we find the oomycota funguses, and this is kind of a microscope slide of the sporing structure. Another very well-known oomycota is the organism that caused potato blight. Okay, potato blight is a fungal infection of potatoes, and what it does is it gets inside of the potato or feeds on the outside of the potato, actually, and causes it to become all mushy. Many of the funguses can produce toxic substances, and in the potato blight, the substance that's released by the fungus is quite toxic to humans. Other funguses release substances that may not be toxic to humans, but may be toxic to other organisms, such as bacteria. A lot of them produce what we would call antibiotics. Okay? In fact, the original antibiotic that was produced in the world is penicillium, which belongs to another group of fungus that we'll talk about a little bit later. Okay? But in the oomycota funguses that produce potato blight, the substance that's produced by them is actually quite toxic to humans. Where have you heard of potato blight? Many of you heard of it before? Where?
Ireland.
Yeah, Ireland. Okay. And you might have heard of the Irish potato famine. That's when we got a lot of Irish immigrants that came to the United States. Basically, what happened is it's kind of an interesting biological and historical story. I love history. If I were to be a multimillionaire, I'd go back to school and become a historian just for fun. In Ireland, Ireland has always tried to be independent from England. I don't know if you knew that. And the English have always tried to subjugate the Irish people. And what would happen, the way that the English ended up subjugating the Irish was the main food crop in Ireland for a long time were grains, such as barley, wheat, and so forth. So what the English would do is they would come in right about harvest time with their armies and burn all the agricultural fields, and therefore the Irish would starve and they would be dependent upon the English for food. Okay. Well, this new plant was introduced from the United States called potato. Potato is native to the New World. And the Irish found that if they grew potatoes, the English couldn't come in and burn their crops because potatoes don't dry out at the end of the year like grains do, right? Okay. And so they started growing all potatoes. The problem was, is after a period of time, this potato blight started running through the potato population, and it ended up starving thousands of people in Ireland. And many of the Irish left Ireland because of the famine there. And a lot of them came to the United States. So the oomycota can cause potato blight. The sporing structure is right here. This is an oosporangia. And the reason why they're called the egg fungi is if you look closely at an oosporangia, it looks like it's filled with little tiny eggs. Okay, that's where the name egg fungus comes from. Any questions about the oomycota? By the way, you can see the, what would we call these strands here without a sporing structure on them? Hyphae, right? Okay. And all these little hyphae together are what we call a what?
Mycelium.
Okay. Any questions about the oomycota? The next division that we want to talk about is the division zygomycota. The division zygomycota are sometimes called the black bread molds because that's probably the best known of the zygomycetes. Okay. So the zygomycota, its distinguishing characteristic is going to be what?
Zygosporangia.
Zygosporangia, that's going to be its sporing structure, okay? Easy enough to remember. Now the zygomycota, again, they're very well known in the black as the bread molds. Here's a picture of the zygomycota infecting black bread molds, and I probably don't need to explain it too much because most of you probably have black bread mold growing in your apartment someplace, right? Or in your house. It's, you know, even if you leave one or two pieces of bread in a bread sack in the cupboard, you generally tend to get black bread mold on it. And what happens is if you watch black bread mold, next time you see it or when you get home, open up your bread sack and look at it, and you'll see that there's actually black bread mold that is growing on the bread outside of where it's really fuzzy. And then certain parts of the black bread mold get to be kind of a fuzzy, look fuzzy in appearance, right? And those are the actual sporing structures where the spores are going to be produced, the zygosporangia. The zygosporangia look different from other sporing structures in that they kind of look like, underneath a microscope, they look a lot like, to me, like a mace. Do all of you know what a mace is? A spike ball. I've had students tell me, and it kind of does look like, it looks like a golf ball with little dimples in it all over the place, okay? So you have these sporing structures called zygosporangia that are held in the hyphae here, okay? And when your black bread mold gets all fuzzy, that's one of the things that's happening, is it's actually produced a sporing structure, okay? Any questions about the zygomycota? The next division of fungus that we want to mention is the division Ascomycota. And what would be the distinguishing characteristic of the Ascomycota? Ascosporangia, easy enough, right? And we'll look at the Ascosporangia here in a minute. A lot of times the Ascomycota are called the cup fungi. Sometimes they are called the... Yeah, typically the cup fungi. I have another name that I remember them by, and I'll tell you here in a minute. The Ascomycota, many of them actually look a lot like mushrooms. Depending on the classification system you're using, Penicillium may be classified in this division, or some scientists classified in one of the other divisions that we have yet to talk about. Okay. Have any of you ever heard of truffles before?
Yeah.
Truffles belong to this group. Also some of the ergots, which are diseases of plants that can actually cause problems with plant and grain production, belong to the Ascomycota. Another name, this is the other common name I was trying to think of, sometimes they're called the sac fungi as well. Typically their sporing structure kind of looks like a little cup, and there's where the name cup fungi comes from. And they have these little sacs that are the sporing structures around this cup-like structure. And so these little sacs are what we call asci, okay, or the ascus. And typically what I think of them as, instead of sac fungi, is, in my mind, I think of them as hot dog fungi, because they look like hot dogs to me, okay, with little seeds in them. These organisms, many times you'll find them on dead and decaying animals out in the wild. You'll find them on dead trees, on dead leaves. They usually are breaking down dead and decaying organic material. These are some pictures of some asci. You can see the spores within the ascus or sac-like structure there. Again, you can see the spores within the ascus here. All right. Any questions about the Ascomycota? The next division we want to talk about is the division Basidiomycota. The division Basidiomycota are sometimes called the club fungi, and their distinguishing characteristic is going to be what?
Basidiosporangia.
Okay. The division Basidiomycota are probably the best known of the funguses, at least to most humans. And we actually eat a lot of this particular type of fungus, especially if you're like me. I love Basidiomycetes, or at least some of them, to eat. One of the Basidiomycetes that probably the best known of them are the mushrooms. Okay, so mushrooms belong to the Basidiomycota. Now, some mushrooms actually produce toxic substances, right? Some of them are antibiotic, and some of them have other properties. Saw some of you smile here. Most of you have heard of magic mushrooms before, produce hallucinogenic substance. And there are other mushrooms, many of the mushrooms produce toxic substances. We don't have a lot of mushrooms around here because we're not really humid, but up in the northwestern United States, there's tons of different types of mushrooms. And eating wild mushrooms, some of them just have delicious taste to them. So people will go out and they'll collect these wild mushrooms and they cook them up in their food. The problem is if you collect the wrong type of mushroom,
You'll hear about this if you live in the Northwest, up by Seattle and so forth. Periodically, every year, you'll hear about an entire family dying. And what's happened is mom or dad or the kids have gone out and collected wild mushrooms. They're not very good at identifying what species they are. And mom will cook up the mushrooms and the whole family will die. Okay. So they can be they can produce toxic substances. Magic mushrooms as a drug is probably one of the most dangerous types of drugs that you can use. Okay. I don't know if you knew that before. The reason why they're so dangerous is because the toxic substances within those magic mushrooms, you never know the concentration. Okay, yeah.
I heard they make your spinal cord bleed or something like that.
They can. They can actually cause permanent damage to your nervous system. So for example, one day if you're using magic mushrooms, you could take a bite and you might just go on a real short trip, right? Okay. The next day, you might take a bite out of another same size or same amount of mushroom from a different mushroom, and the concentrations of the toxin may be so high that you go on a permanent vacation. Okay. In fact, there's a kid that's a couple years older than me that grew up here in Ephraim. He wanders around town. Some of you might have seen him. He's got really long hair. Looks really cringy. It's up by Mr. Stack there. He knows who I'm talking about. And actually, that's what happened to him. He was a real bright kid in high school. He got eating magic mushrooms, and now he's basically a burnout. Isn't he?
Yes. Yeah,
really kind of scary.
Every once in a while, he'd still catch and see how he was such a bright kid.
Every once in a while, he'll see me, and he'll remember my name and stuff. And then he'll see me. I know you, don't I? And, he can't even really walk straight because he has so much neurological damage that's kind of...
Looks like he's drunk 24/7.
Yeah, he does. And he usually is, but...
Granted.
But he's had so much neurological damage from those magic mushrooms. So that's why it's such a dangerous drug to use. Some other basidiomycetes that you might be familiar with are smuts and rusts. Smuts are fungi that get into... grain crops especially. Rusts get on trees. Sometimes you'll get these little growths on trees and your tree starts dying. I don't know if any of you have ever seen that, especially in fruit trees. Those are rusts that are actually a basidiomycota. But smuts, they get into grasses and they can totally destroy grass crops and grain crops like wheat. This is the sporing structure of the basidiomycota. And in the gills of the mushroom, that's where you will find the Basidia sporangia, is right here. When you look close up at the Basidia sporangia, they look like a club that you would hit somebody with. Therefore, the common name of the club fungi. Okay? So this is what the Basidia sporangia would look like. Just some pictures of some different mushrooms. This one here is Psychosilum. I don't know if I say that right. The genus name, it's actually magic mushrooms. Okay, that's what they look like. This is a puffball. Puffballs also belong to this group. A lot of times you'll see puffballs on, say for example, a cow pie. I don't know how many of you have seen that, or on a dead tree or something. And when you step on these, powder just goes all over. And basically what it is millions of spores. Okay. Have you ever seen these before, anybody?
Yeah.
They can
foam.
Yeah, it's actually, but they go up in the air like dust. Those are all spores. Puffballs, I've seen puffballs, as small as a dime, but I've actually seen puffballs, almost as big as a basketball before. So they vary quite greatly in size. Any questions about the Basidiomycota?